Could I call to order the Customer Service and Operations Committee? Can I ask for a motion for the approval of the agenda? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Approval of the minutes of March the 10th, 2011. Motion made and seconded. Any comments? Hearing none. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Hearing none. The minutes are approved. First item on information is vital signs.
Okay. Next slide. First slide, please. Good morning. Andrea Burnside, Chief Performance Officer. And my presentation this morning will summarize the recent results for our operational and safety performance indicators, indicate key actions we're taking to improve performance. And I will be reporting on performance for March for most of our indicators, with the exception of the safety and security measures, which of the available data is through February at the time the report was written. This month, I also have a focus on target setting and on the practice of benchmarking. Next slide, please. So moving to our KPIs first, I'd like to make a general observation to the committee that Metro's performance is moving in the right direction. Of the 13 high-level KPIs that we report to this committee monthly, 12 have improved for the reporting month. Looking first at our operational KPIs, the good news with rail on-time performance is that it's improved for the third month in a row, and we're seeing the best results in about five quarters since November of 2009. We've concluded midday track work and have a renewed focus on on-time dispatching of trains. The Red Line state of good repair work results in benefits such as fewer track issues, a reduction in the number of speed restrictions, and all that ultimately rolls up to improved on-time performance. Bus on-time performance continued a steady improvement as a result of better departure and arrival monitoring and effective scheduling for special events, as you know, which start largely in the spring with the cherry blossom and other happenings in town. Fleet reliability declined slightly for bus, but was still above target. Decline relates to wide variation in temperature in March. We had some really hot days and some cold days. Buses working hard to flatline these seasonal fluctuations to stabilize our mean distance between failure over the year. Each bus fleet, whether it's CNG, hybrid, clean diesel, or other, has its own unique issues, and we're trying to address them as quickly as possible. Over the years, the HVAC preparation for the summer and winter has been strengthened, so there's less of a shock to the system when the temperature goes up in the summer and down in the winter. We're already seeing success in FY11 with these efforts because the mean distance between failure is the highest it's been in 10 years. Access on-time performance improved as staff continue to focus on scheduling and route efficiencies. We've talked to the committee about that before. And escalator availability improved slightly over the prior month due to quicker resolution of unscheduled service calls. However, both escalator and elevator availability have declined compared to the same time frame last year. Next slide. Looking at our safety and security measures, this is a very good news slide that's showing that the total number of Part 1 crimes, again, for the February month hit a two-year low. We do typically see a seasonal drop in February because the bad guys don't like to come out in the cold weather, frankly. So February is typically lower, as well as it having fewer number of days, so the number of incidents is lower that are reported. Customer and employee injuries also decreased in February, with customer injuries on bus reaching the lowest levels in over a year. Buses had a strong focus on safe driving behavior, and we've been utilizing the great new tool that we have, which is DriveCam, that you're familiar with. Next slide. Looking at the actions we're taking to improve performance going forward, we're conducting studies of bus service along Martin Luther King, Georgia Avenue, Rhode Island Avenue, and 14th Street to improve the quality of service. And this is, even though the slide only reflects DC, we're also, we have studies distributed throughout our service area. So we have looking at the 5A to Dulles, the B30 to BWI, and 7 lines in Virginia. So it's looking across our service area. The Rail Operation Control Center monitors incident response times, identifying improved communication between the control center staff and response teams that we have stationed throughout our system and available to resolve incidents quicker, especially during the peak travel times. In March, when we discussed the escalator program approach with you, we told you that we were improving our management and alignment of resources in the elevator escalator group. We've actually taken this even further through a detailed focus on quality and efficiency of our maintenance procedures. So as we repair and maintain units, we get things right the first time around, which is a very good thing. Bus started a drive cam. I think we're on the next slide. Bus started a drive cam campaign called Keep It Green, and which is kind of funny because it basically aims at training operators to drive safely all day, thereby preventing the triggering of the red light that goes on with drive cam when there's a risky driving occurrence. So Keep It Green means don't let the red go on. Don't, you know, make sudden movements that make the bus stop suddenly. On April 27th, Metro Transit Police Department hosted a roundtable for regional police chiefs to discuss strategies for reducing crime on the metro system and identify opportunities for collaboration. And a positive outcome has been distribution of passes, metro passes, to jurisdictional officers in Prince George's County. And we will be giving, if we haven't already, more passes to other jurisdictions as a result of the roundtable. Next slide. Moving to our performance targets. So we committed to come back to the committee to talk about our targets and wanted to kind of start off with, you know, what is the purpose of having targets? Because we haven't always had targets in the past for all the measures. The purpose of having targets is to show progress, you know, basically, and also to promote a transparent and accountable operation and organization. Targets has been a discussion with this group, and Mr. McKay in particular, I believe, at the February meeting, asked how we had established the targets that are currently in vital signs. I replied at the time that these were legacy targets that we had adopted as we got the vital signs report going and started to bring all the different ways that we report performance into one consistent report. Of course, it's a good practice to reevaluate your targets on a regular basis, as well as when there's different conditions that impact your operation. And a good example of that would be when we purchase a lot of new buses, we would expect that we would have better fleet reliability. And so the target at that time that the buses come on board should be adjusted. We've completed our first round of regular annual target reevaluations with the executive team and approved by our general manager, CEO. And some of the things that we discussed together and considered in establishing and setting the new targets were the type of targets that we wanted to set. Did we want kind of an actual number or a percentage improvement or reduction? The time frame. So we've selected a calendar year focus with the targets tagged to progress by the end of the calendar year 2011. We looked at trend data for calendar years 2009 and calendar year 2010. So obviously you want to know how have you been performing before you decide what you want your target to be. And we also looked at internal capabilities and external constraints. So and I'll be talking about one of those when I get to escalators, you know, which is a popular topic. The GM CEO was presented with this and approved the targets with the executive team. Next slide. So moving more to the specifics. In looking at customer injury rate, this is a new measure this year that the Chief Safety Officer established based on National Transit Database reporting. A key requirement for this measure is that the injured party was transported for medical treatment to be included in this count. It includes rail passenger injuries on board, in facilities, on escalators, and bus and access passenger injuries. So this is a high-level roll-up measure for all the different types of injuries that are experienced throughout the metro system. The rolled up target, the new target, is less than 2.02 injuries per million passengers. And this reflects just under a 5% reduction of our average experience in calendar year 2010. So it is an improvement target. Next slide. Moving to employee injuries, also a new measure this year established by the Chief Safety Officer that's based on OSHA reporting. And it is measures reportable employee accidents per 200,000 work hours, so it's a rate. The target for 2011 is less than 5.55 injuries per 200,000 hours and reflects a desired improvement over the average in 2010. Next slide, crimes. We reported on a crime rate before publicly, but a target had not existed before. So in talking about this, we established a new target of an improvement over the experience in calendar 2010. So we're looking to come in with fewer than 2,279 Part 1 crimes. And we have had a good start to the year. So you look at, you know, what do you need to do monthly to get to your year-end target? And to achieve the target by year's end, realizing that crime is kind of up and down and there's seasonal trends. As I mentioned earlier, February tends to be a low month for crime.
Mr. Giancola had a question.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Could you go back to the previous chart? Again, I know I've asked this question, and sometimes the statistics are reported later than normal, but don't we have any March numbers on this chart? And here we are at the end of May, and at least for injury rates for employees, you'd think we'd know certainly through March what our injury were. So I was just curious, why is there such a long time lag to have updated numbers there?
Well, I think part of the challenge this month is, and we normally have been, because of the timing of when the reports are due with the committee cycle, we just don't have the data available. However, Mr. Doherty reports in the Safety and Security Committee just a week or two after we normally do.
So tell me what happens at the end of February. What kind of report is submitted and by whom and by when on say, a division's injury rate or whoever collects the data on injury?
I probably would need somebody from risk management.
Just seems like it's a long time. I'm just having trouble with how long it takes to get internally what our injury rate is or injuries. That's all. And I don't need an answer right now. If you go to the next chart, same question, crimes. You know, here we are, you know, in the end of May, and yet we don't have March figures for crime rates or crimes.
We had March figures 2 weeks ago, so
yeah.
Why they aren't?
This meeting is a little bit later than it normally is, so we would normally be earlier in the month.
Question.
We strive to get the information, you know, as fresh information as is available to us at the time the report's produced.
A question from Mr. Wells.
Just a quick question to understand, to go back a little bit about the bus reliability. How does a board member or even the public have access to the disaggregated data to be able to determine by bus lines, since there'd be pretty wild variation within bus reliability in terms of on-time performance?
Well, I mean, through vital signs, we're only striving to show the high-level measures, and so we haven't focused on providing that much detail here. I think, you know, that is something that certainly that the scheduling folks in bus look at on a regular basis, but I'd have to ask the bus folks or the scheduling folks to address how it's made publicly. I don't believe it is at this time.
Well, I don't want to derail or, you know, get too far off agenda, but that is something, again, that for it to be meaningful in relationship to bus reliability, taking that in the aggregate is you know, I don't know how helpful that really is.
And I had earlier asked a question about whether or not it was possible to integrate NextBus data into the schedule so that you can do an evaluation pretty much almost in real time by bus line with that NextBus data in terms of performance, but I'm not sure that NextBus reliability is there yet, but it is a question that's been asked a number of times. If we can track on NextBus the exact location of all of these buses in the system, we can overlay that against the schedule, and we should be able to develop a target line. Specific line performance measures.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. McKay?
Yes. Question on the injury rate and the new targets. Is this a combined, both for employee and customer, are these combined figures that are a combination of, you know, self-inflicted injuries versus system perhaps induced injuries? Is this an overall number, or is this a number that only reflects injuries that could have been the responsibility of the system and not just necessarily a customer or an employee error?
This is a roll-up number. It's kind of a no-fault roll-up number. Somebody got injured. It's all injuries.
Okay. Because I understand the target, but of course, I've raised this issue before in the past that if the public is looking at this, it could be a little bit misleading, and it may look like these injuries are all caused by an error in the system or a deficiency in the metro system versus something that somebody might have done that had nothing to do with the fact that we had an unsafe situation, for example. And I don't know if there's an easy way to do it, but I think at a minimum on these charts and what we put out to the public, we should put that this number is a combined figure of all injuries, some of which may not have been caused by the system itself, but may have been an oversight of a customer or an employee, but not necessarily a deficiency in our system. So if we can't divide the two, we should at least put that in the data so that people know what they're looking at.
Mr. Nichols.
Thank you. Just a quick question, and I realize this is not a discussion of the particular operations. It's more the reporting of the data. But on the crime rate, the under the why, the first bullet point was a little confusing to me, that the rate of the activity is increasing, but the intent is to bring it below the 2010 level. And just could you go into that just for a moment, please? I mean, I'm not sure that I fully understand what we're trying to say here. I understand the bottom line point, but
I think we're trying to say that, even though we've experienced a significant increase in snatches of small devices,
right,
it's been driving up our overall number, we're still trying to come in better than, so we're coming in with an improvement target that we've had an upward tick, and we're still trying to come in better than what we have in the last year.
So from an absolute standpoint, you want to bring in at 22, below 2279,
yes,
the number, although you see the trending going up right
That's
now.
That's correct.
Okay. So, again, I won't go to the security service aspect of it. We'll talk about that as we talk about it with the chief and others, but that's the goal intent. Okay.
Actually, I think I was speaking on this slide when I left off last time. I started to say that you mentioned that upward tick. We actually had a good start to the year. So in order to achieve the annual target, we look at what would we need to experience per month. So we would need to experience about 190 crimes per month, realizing that that's just a simple average over 12 months, but it really is up and down. And on average, during the first quarter of the year, calendar year, so January, February, March, we've only had 139 per month. So we're already exceeding, our 190.
So the rate is actually below the 2010 rate right now, as opposed to increasing upward.
That's
is
right.
that right? On a calendar year basis. So that's not quite. So it's actually trending down and not up. Is that right?
I think we're talking about kind of looking to trends over the last couple of years of snatches of small
right.
devices, and Chief Tabor might want to speak to that more specifically.
Thanks.
Sure. That electronic devices, that's one and only one of the part one type crimes. And so that's the area that
is trending up.
Trending up.
Okay.
But
okay.
Overall
trending down, but that piece is trending up.
Yeah.
Okay, that clarifies
it's kind
that great.
Like,
right. Thank you.
Different trends in crime, but different type of crimes occur in different time periods.
Okay, thank you.
Why don't we let you continue, and then we'll probably have more questions.
Okay, next slide. Rail on time performance. The legacy target, as you may know, has been 95%. On-time performance for rail is measured by line during weekday peak and off-peak periods. And during the AM and PM peak, we consider station stops made within the scheduled headway, which is the time between trains, is what headway means, plus 2 minutes to be on time. During non-peak, we consider station stops made within the scheduled headway plus no more than 50% of the scheduled headway to be on time. The new target is established at 90% or better. And this new target reflects a number of very careful considerations and is backed by good data from our experience. So we know, looking at our numbers, not only from 2009, but going back to the late 1990s and early 2000 period when we were in manual mode, that manual train operations can be pegged to about a 5% reduction in performance. And part of that, to explain that, in manual mode, operators need additional time to manually stop at stations and open and close the doors. There's more variability among operators, so we have some very experienced operators who might be able to stop on a dime and some who are a little more hesitant, and you all may have ridden the train when you're kind of like, I'm going to stop, you know, a couple times as I get to the stop line. We're also now moving trains to the end of the platform at the 8-car stopping line, so they got to really hit that mark. And also one thing that we don't talk about that much, but in automatic train operation, there isn't as much conversation between the control center and the operator as there is going on right now when the control center is giving instructions to the operator all the time, you know, hold here. And I think I've noticed myself writing the system that the operators are really sharing a lot more good information with customers. We're holding here because there's a train on the platform, or when the other day even said we're holding here to keep our on-time performance, you know, our headway adherence consistent. So I think that's very positive. But all those things added up together does that show a 5% reduction in our performance. As mentioned, targets should be reevaluated when operating conditions change. So when we return to automatic train operation, we would definitely readjust that target back up, the 5%. We're coming back to this committee with a performance spotlight in the fall, September timeframe, that will give you a lot more information and detailed look into rail on-time performance.
Ms. Burnside, I actually have a question about the headway time, or the how big is the gap where you're considered to be on time?
2 minutes.
2 minutes.
2 minutes.
And is that all day? So I had gotten so it's not all day.
That's during the peak periods.
Okay. And yeah. What's on time defined as when I'm not in the peak?
It's the headway plus 50%.
Okay. So
you add it, you know.
So if the trains are running 15-minute headways, it's 9 minutes?
No,
22.
Okay, so yeah. One of the concerns I have about that is, as you know, when we're off peak, particularly for people who have to transfer, this does it line up, and can I reasonably expect I might be able to catch a train in 5 or 6 minutes with a 22-minute gap considered on time? I just feel like we're not that doesn't really feel like on time to the rider. And I'm wondering if you kept that gap, the 2 minutes, or, you know, some smaller increment than this larger one, whether we would see something different. Because I think for our riders who are riding, particularly in the evenings, the long waits can be really long, given and still be considered on time.
Changed that definition and made it tighter, I'm sure you would see a reduction in performance that we would report. Yes.
Right, but
it might be accurate.
I guess it's partly about what we're trying to accomplish for the customer, and so I would wonder about that.
Mr. Acosta?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point. I was actually in the New York Times the other day. There was an article about how the MTA up there measures on-time performance, and they actually came up with an indicator called a weight assessment, which actually focuses on the ability of the train to meet intervals as opposed to – because that's actually what the customer experiences at the off-peak period. So it might be interesting just to take a look at that. Mm-hmm. I think it's fairly new, but – just to see if there's an alternative measure that may accomplish something more realistic in terms of what the customer experiences, you know, as they travel our system.
Yeah,
Mr. Gianco, I'm sorry.
Yeah, we've had this conversation before. In fact, a couple months back, I remember some charts comparing some other, whether it was the bus systems and or rail systems in other locations, even some of our other regional services. And I think it's something we probably need to have a look at again, Mr. Chair. So I would suggest maybe at a future meeting we kind of look at the how we determine on-time performance again.
And the good news is we're already scheduled to come back to you in September with that discussion, so we can get into a lot more detail on this one particular measure.
Good. Why don't we talk at it at the next staff agenda setting about how we address that. Mr. Downing?
I had a question on more with respect to bus on-time performance. It's in some ways a philosophical question about the purpose of vital signs. I think vital signs, as I see it, is a measure of how well the authority is meeting its obligation to the customer, how efficient, how effective. And I get the sense on bus on time, we're turning it into more like a weather forecast. Say, well, we don't have any control, but this is 70% chance of rain, so bring your umbrella. If we, particularly with bus, and particularly with routes where people work off a schedule, it's not 10-minute headways like the circulator, it's the bus is due here at 8:13, come down and you have a reasonable chance of catching it. When you get down to targets as low as 78%, this is saying to the customer, we can't tell you when the bus is coming, but we're comfortable that it's only 78%. If the reasoning is congestion is out on the roadways and the like, it may be that we have to consider appropriate schedules. I don't think we should deal with bad schedule performance by saying it's got to be bad. If it takes longer to run the route, we may just have to change the schedule. But I think particularly for those riders, meeting their time expectation is the most important factor, that they have some degree of confidence that if they come at the scheduled time, the bus will be there. We already have, in my recollection of the earlier discussion, the biggest window with respect to bus on-time performance of any property that I've ever seen. And we're saying, but even within that, there's only a 78% chance it will be within a 9-minute window. That's saying good luck.
I would like to add that internally we're undertaking a strong effort to review the appropriateness of our current on-time performance definition and targets, in addition to reevaluating schedules and priority corridors. And we know that we can learn from our peers, so we
I
are.
Think the process
yeah.
should be we have level of quality we hope to achieve. That level of quality is 80% or 85%. Then we say, what are the resources we need to achieve that? What are the schedules that would allow it? Not just saying we've cut the schedules on some particular basis and we don't care whether we meet them on a quality standpoint. And it might be good to have some further conversations with the customers about what their expectations are, what they're really looking for in the way of that service.
Can I just comment on that a little bit? And I agree that we should try to set up the expectations right. And I'm not a bus scheduler, but I think one of the things you have to consider is the variability of traffic. Some days it's very congested, some days it's not, and how you hit that schedule point that you try to be there most times, but there's also an issue. It's not a matter of, yeah, every day it's going to be congested so we can schedule right to that. There's a lot of variability. So I think that's one of the things that schedules have to consider. And certainly, if we can do it better, we should.
And if I could follow up on that, I think Mr. Downing is exactly right, and I think that we have to address that. And, you know, as you were saying, Mr. Downs, especially in using NextBus, if someone walks up to a bus stop and they expect a bus is coming in 10 minutes, and if they're waiting 40 minutes or an hour, that's just, and we have the technology and the ability to say right there in a, you know, either a sign at the bus stop, or for those that have smartphones, actually it's not going to be here for another 40 minutes or an hour, that the relationship with that technology is extremely important. And and again, the window is such a large window to say what's you know, the reliability. It's you get into this issue with these targets like statistics of how you can drown in a river that only averages 8 inches deep. You know, it really is not that helpful. So if we can figure out a way to really relate back from a report to us that relates and back to quality experience improvement for the rider is going to be most meaningful. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
One of the things that, Mr. Wells and I went through both the northern and western garages recently and looked at the mean miles between failure by a bus garage. The variances within the system, to use Mr. Downey's analogy, that it's like a weather forecast, using the data on a system-wide basis doesn't give you accountability about specific performance, even by garage level, let alone route level. It's like forecasting rain someplace on the East Coast. And the variances on mean miles between failure, which has a significant impact on on-time performance, might be helped by better focusing on performance by garage and performance by type of equipment that could at least help us understand what's happening within the system. Not to micromanage or not to second guess, but to simply understand the dynamic about what is happening within bus service. Because there seems to be a lot of variance within the regional system about how the bus system performs on an on-time basis.
And we certainly can provide more information, understanding that management doesn't use just the overall figure today and say, oh, things are good or bad.
Right.
It actually drills down to that, and that's how you identify the root cause, but certainly providing more information to the board is doable.
I also want to agree with what's been said, and the issue with a particular bus line is the critical one, because people are less concerned about how the overall bus system performs than they are about the reliability of the particular line that they may rely on to get to work in the morning. I had for a couple of years the unfortunate necessity of relying on a very unreliable bus line, and at one point made a formal request for information on why this bus was always sometimes as much as half an hour late, and the information I received back was that it met the on-time performance requirements for that line, which I will tell you as a bus rider, the impression that left me with was that WMATA didn't care if the bus showed up half an hour late. I mean, that was clearly the message that I received as a bus rider. It is a very difficult issue because bus on-time performance is not just traffic, it's also the behavior of riders. You know, we all know you wait there for half an hour and then two buses show up. But there must be a technological fix to this. I mean, other entities that move vehicles around on a regular schedule work on this through technological fixes. There must be a technological fix to figure out how you get a bus to a particular place at a particular time, given variable behavior of people getting on and off the bus. But that should be our goal. That should be the kind of thing that we're working on, because, you know, I have told people that, you know, if you have to be somewhere on time, you really can't rely on the buses. And I'm not just talking about WMATA, I'm talking about buses in general, because it's an issue of buses have such a difficulty getting places on time. But we should try and make that better. If we really are trying to make the bus system something that people can use to get places where they need to get on time, work, a doctor's appointment, we really need to figure out how to get individual buses to individual places where they need to be on something much closer to the published times.
I was going to mention also we have some information from the Texas Transportation Institute, but nationwide, it's estimated that about 55% of the congestion is what's called non-recurring. So non-recurring would be kind of unanticipated, unexpected things like and hard to plan for, like accidents, weather, special events, work zones. That's a pretty big number to be working against. It's sort of an unknown. I think we can probably do better, but that is a challenge that we would face.
is there a way to change scheduling in real time? Maybe not, aside from next bus. Is there a way to change bus schedules in real time so that if there's an accident, you just drop the schedule back 20 minutes or 15 minutes so that at least people know?
Well, I do believe they make adjustments on the fly, but that's not reflected in kind of the base schedules that are not flexible enough to change on a daily or hourly basis.
Mr. Downing.
Just noting, too, our main competitor, the automobile, has exactly the same problems, but I think we can offer more information about it. And certainly most of the research that I've seen suggests reliability and predictability is of greater importance than speed for many people. It's knowing when you have to get there in order to achieve the trip. It's not saying how fast it is.
And part of it, we're talking in some respects parallel issues. On the one hand is how we measure against our scheduled headways. The other, which is how do you react to and how do you impart information when half the time there's a lot of variability due to traffic congestion. One's a static measure when you're talking about on-time performance. You're against a published schedule. The other is when you have traffic jam or an accident, how we convey, and this is to Mr. Wells' point before, how do we convey to a person that, in fact, there are going to be delays and roughly what they are, and that's either through dynamic signs at some bus stops or it's through email alerts and that sort of thing. So I think we're looking at two things that they're not – if I get 100% an on-time performance, which, well, of course, I'll never get, it's not necessarily the same thing as telling the person that there's a delay and that sort of thing. So I think there's two things we have to work on.
Mr. Giancola.
Yeah, what I would like to add to that briefing in September on the determination of on-time performance is maybe an update on the next bus program, only in a sense of, since we do know that there's a lot of construction always going on in this town, in the metropolitan area, can next bus, through its system, advise people on certain routes? By the way, you've asked for the route schedule on this particular route for the period of umpy squat to umpy squat. You know, the road's under construction and you're going to witness delays. In other words, is there some way through the next bus system where we can in fact advise customers when they check in that on a particular route there will be problems or feeder routes will be problems?
Good suggestion.
I just wanted to clarify that the September was going to be a very focused spotlight on rail on-time performance, but we can certainly address the bus on-time performance as well.
We don't have to wait until September, okay? So at the next customer service meeting, we'll answer those questions, okay?
Thank you.
Could I also suggest on rail on-time performance, while I appreciate the operation in manual mode contributing to 5%, I noticed that we're 15% below the target level of 60,000 miles for rail reliability, and the bulk of that seems to be in the 4,000 series car based on the performance indicators that you've reported about rail car availability, and the gap between the 4,000 series and the 6,000 series is now huge. It seems to be 83,000 miles difference between breakdowns between the 4,000 and the 6,000 series. And since those 4,000 series cars are all over the system in various train consist, that drags the system performance, the rail on-time performance down significantly. At some point, we have to address the fact that we have a fleet full of dogs here in the 4,000 series car, and it's killing us about predictable reliability. At some point, we have to address a serious fix, either that or scrap these things, for the rail system, and maybe that can be part of the September review as well.
Again, the 4,000 series, it is a 100% DC car. Okay, it is a unique car. Another big challenge that we have at this agency, and a lot of our time has been focused on has been on the 1000 series since we have to belly those cars. 25% of your fleet has to be bellied. There's nobody else in the United States or probably the world that has that requirement at this stage. We have focused on the 1000 series and our rehabs and our new cars, the 6000 series, to get those through the project, the programs, to get them upgraded with the right technology. Now we begin the focus on the 4000 series, knowing that we're going to have to run these things probably for another 6 to 8 years, if not longer. And what can we do with these, you know, respective systems that are out there? We're looking at the main focus right now is the reliability of the overall electrical system itself in regards to auxiliary supplies and how it responds when it's train line with these other fleets. We have seen it, and we wish that we had the flexibility. We used to be able to run these cars in light consists, which improved their numbers dramatically. So as we go through this, you will probably see some funding requests for various parts and systems that comes through this process to start making those respective improvements. But the braking system itself is very unique. The propulsion system definitely is a dinosaur, and the auxiliary power supply is where, in the other aux for air conditioning and everything else, is our primary focus indoors. Those are the areas that we've got to focus on there. So we can provide, you know, further detail on that, but based on our operating condition, we cannot mask them anymore. You know, and like I said, when we were operating the light consists and you see the on-time performance and some of the other alignments, I agree wholeheartedly that if the fleets are moving, it increases the reliability.
The numbers are just huge. When I saw that, I was stunned.
Now, there has been some movement, and we were actually breaking it down on a – for a while you see the report, say, for instance, it's broken down on a specific fleet type. We're pulling the respective data, and, you know, we're dissecting the respective systems, you know, naturally. Again, this is a very high roll-up. So that way we know where we need to spend our money or what we need to do as far as, you know, making certain adjustments and such.
I've got to say that I'm appreciative of the data systems that report this before without this kind of accurate performance data. These issues don't actually get addressed, and I'm thankful that you all have gone to so much time and effort to produce the actual performance data that lets this become an issue.
Question?
Mr. Nichols.
Thank you for the report, and thank you. It is good information. I guess the question that I have is more from a strategic and a planning standpoint. I think the report addresses the whether you agree with the target or not, it achieves a measurement of how we perform against whatever we establish as a target based on the factors that we can control. Question I have at the moment is, from a strategic standpoint, where is the forum where you address and discuss the issues that impede rising above the target to a higher aspiration? For example, from a regional perspective, if there are more dedicated bus lanes, for example, that might begin to reduce the impact of certain types of congestion you might encounter that are more transportation planning related. In what forum do you engage with jurisdictions on discussions of those kinds of opportunities for reducing the impact of congestion on buses and their free flow?
We've actually, through COG, as well as direct discussions with the jurisdictions, the DOTs, in that specific case, have developed over the years plans for addressing improved bus operation, prioritization, all that sort of thing. Funding was obtained, I think, in the last year to further those studies, and we are advancing that with the DOTs. There's been some recent discussions, in particular with Montgomery County, and also with the district on specific lines to address it. So that's where that takes place, because it's a multi-agency function. So COG is a good
form for that, but then also an actual implementation would go directly to the DOTs.
So do we see, is there a time frame that you've been able to establish at this point where those kinds of recommendations will begin to go forward and those changes? What are we looking
at? In the planning, there are time frames for that as well. The time frames right now are to accomplish the planning, not necessarily the implementation.
Because to me, that while we can fix a lot of the things, whether it be to get an improved bus fleet or more drivers or all the kinds of things that are there, I think there is required a strategic collaborative approach with the jurisdictions to really create an environment where we can actually allow the buses to run more efficiently, notwithstanding other factors.
And that's been laid out in the planning. And, in fact, I'd be glad to give the board or jurisdictions individually a briefing on where the plans are for each individual jurisdiction.
That would be great. Thanks. Ms. Porter?
One more thing on the on-time performance. I think there's two ways of thinking about reliability issues. One is sort of from a systems operations perspective. You need a certain amount of equipment that operates a certain percentage of time, and you can get it out there on a regular basis and move it from one place to another on an efficient basis. And that's sort of, I mean, we have to think of it that way because we are, in fact, operating the system. But when you think of on-time performance from a customer perspective, it may look very different. And from a customer perspective, it's often very simple. How long do I have to wait at the bus stop past the time that's published? How long do I have to wait on the platform before the next train shows up? And it would be very useful, I think, for our relationship with our customers and the perception that the system is reliable by the people who use it, if we could figure out a way to mirror that second way of looking at on-time performance, perhaps more than we do. I think that would be a very useful thing for the board also.
I don't know if you've finished your presentation or not.
So why don't we try to get to the end of the presentation, and we'll have the rest of the questions at the end.
Okay, next, escalators. Our old target was 93% or better, and we've revised that to 89% or better. This is a stretch target. We expect our annual average availability in 2010 to further decline because of needed capital overhauls that will take twice as many units out of service. So using March 2011 as an example, there were 98% more capital overhaul out of service hours than March 2010. Also, with regard to preventive maintenance, improving to the 60% compliance rate that we had talked with this committee about before will likely have a negative impact on the availability measure, because we expect to identify a backlog of repairs to be addressed. The good news is that next year performance should be improving as all the work that we're doing right now makes escalators more reliable and reduces the number of unscheduled repairs. And then when the units do go out of service, we'll resolve those problems quicker as parts are available and that sort of thing. So we would anticipate raising this target in 2012. Customer comment rate, this is a new measure, so we've established.
I hate to interrupt. I'll do this once. The authority used to have a policy that off-peak station managers would shut down escalators to save energy when there were multi-escalators in a bank. There seems to be, at least in my experience and several other folks, a number of times where escalators are shut down and they're not being worked on or repaired. Does the authority still shut down escalators off peak?
No.
Good. When escalators are simply off, does that count about escalator availability?
Yes.
And if there are these areas where they're off, at least I want to congratulate you on, if there's only one escalator running, it's running in the up mode. Not always, but in a lot more cases.
We're trying to do better.
And the other is, that at peak hour, in walk mode, in some stations, it's actually unsafe, given the crowds, the crush of folks trying to walk down a single escalator. And there seems to be a continuing problem with it in a couple of stations. And I don't know what to do with it, but if it counts about escalator availability and they're not being overhauled, maintained, or in any other way being worked on, there's got to be a way to improve the availability time for escalators that are simply shut off.
We do have another large challenge on this as a byproduct. Whenever we take down an escalator, for example, for repair, and we only have two, it's a two-bank system, that means that we have to take the other bank off, and it becomes a walker. That unit being down counts against our availability, you know, and so we do take the harshest measurement to make sure that we're trying to be as, you know, as forthright with the customer experience out there. But as we see it, this is, and as Andrea noted, we'll be probably about 90% more work effort out there as far as capital than what you see this year.
I'd also add, since Dave and Rodrigo know, they get little emails from me about escalators, that a number of times when you see an escalator out of service and no work on it, it could be because of safety trip. The other night, somebody got their luggage stuck in the escalator somehow, and safety tripped, and it took going back, first identifying the problem, going back and actually having to repair the switch. So that takes time. But in the meantime, you leave it operational as a walker, because at least there's some access. And the same thing with, could be just a need of a repair. It breaks down. There's no need to barricade it off. It's a safe and a walker position, so people will see it sitting there, and they may be waiting for the off hours, or they may have to get a part. It takes a couple of days. So those are the times when you see it as a walker. It doesn't look like it's being worked on, but in fact, there's a reason for it being out. And there are occasions when somebody should have restarted the escalator and could have, but that's, in my experience, one of the rarer occasions.
Mr. Downing?
I don't know that we should complicate the measure, but my perspective, there is a difference between a long-term outage for rebuilding, which I gather you're counting as part of the number,
yes,
versus the random nature of when I show up, I don't know if it'll run or not. And once I know it'll be gone for 3 months, I may use a different station, I may use a different exit. The really frustrating factor for the customer is never knowing which escalator might be out of service at any given time. It might be worth at least identifying here how much of the difference from target relates to the random versus the planned.
And we can do that. For my reporting to me, we actually have a pie chart which breaks it down between preventive maintenance, out for, you know, random repairs, outage, as well as for rebuilding. So, I mean, we can provide that to the board.
And I wouldn't want to see us not repair elevators in order to make the number go better.
But exactly. We're trying to take the medicine now, get it fixed so that future it's better.
Mr. Downs.
I'd also like to add, because we appreciate we had a meeting with, or my staff did, with the JCC. Also, whenever you're seeing escalators that are out, at times, sometimes before they're permitted to be put back into service, we have to have a local jurisdiction inspect them. And so staff reached out through the JCC process to also to be able to have a better understanding of who we contact in these respective jurisdictions, because we have seen areas where we've had escalators sit out for months because we cannot, you know, we're not permitted, you know, really to put that thing in, you know, back into service. And we have seen that happen before. So when you're talking weeks and days and you put that together. Now, that's been an isolated case, but that's an example that we have to deal with. And so we are trying to look at all facets and phases of this escalator maintenance effort.
That has not been a recent experience.
Yeah.
Mr. Downs, I'm listening to all this, and I'm wondering, I mean, one of the issues is I get off the train, I know where I have to go, and then I get there and it's this long flight up, and if I'd known I had to walk up, I might have decided to take the elevator. And what I'm wondering is whether there's any way to use our signage, our electronic signage, maybe this is something you've all discussed before, to, when a train pulls into the station, to say, you know, escalators working at this exit and that exit. And I don't know whether that's possible or not, but it seems to me that we have a tool there that we might not be using.
On the passenger information display, the sign that's there in the stations, that only has the ability to handle so much data. A lot of times, whenever we have a lot of irregular issues with it, they pretty much have to clear everything out because it is limited in characters as well as the amount of content. So we are looking at maybe a more advanced, you know, PID-type system, but to be able to rely on that on a regular basis would be very difficult. We do broadcast whenever we have, for example, planned outages, you know, on the PID system, and that's something that we could forecast, but the ability to update, you know, real live time information, it doesn't have the platform at this time to sustain something like that.
I would really hope we would get to that place. The last question I have really is this one around, we're in pain now because it's going to get better later, which is part of what I took, Ms. Burnside, from your presentation. And one of my concerns overall about where we're going with the agency is that we need to help the public understand that that's really the scenario we're in. We got some bad months coming, but at the end, it's going to be better. And I just don't know if you've focused on this particular area as an area where we could try some of that messaging before we get to some of our bigger choices where that's going to have to be the message.
We are, Barbara Richardson, we are, it's part of a program that we're working on, we are rolling it out. In particular, also, we're going to be looking at the signage and with Dave's team on the escalators. We're developing a package of signage that would be informative as well, that would talk about what's going on behind the barricade that you see. And we'll also help them refresh the outage signs, the yellow signs that are placed that determine when it's going to be back up. So very much, yes, we agree that that's an opportunity.
And so that'll happen. We'll start seeing some of that in the next month or two.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Mm-hmm. Actually, we started, we've done behind-the-scenes tours of some of the capital work already. We unveiled our new buses, and we had a field trip, if you will. And, pardon me? With reporters, but to reach customers. And so we'll see more of that and some other activities as well, and I'll be updating you on that.
Why don't we try and get through the rest of the report? We have a relatively non-controversial item that we need to deal with next. So,
customer comment rate, as I mentioned, this is a new measure, and we've established 2010 as a baseline with a target of more than 10.5 commendations per million passengers and less than 135 complaints per million passengers. These would reflect an improvement over our average rates in 2010. Next slide. Benchmarking. Just wanted to talk a little bit about benchmarking, which has been a discussion item with the committee. Benchmarking has a number of benefits, including that it's a very common business practice. It's intuitive to ask yourself how you're doing compared to others and your peers. You can identify high-performing peers that you can observe and learn best practices from. And it conveys performance results to policymakers such as yourself. Benchmarking is done very well in the international arena, so in looking at who does it well, because we want to be like them, with groups like Nova being a medium-sized rail properties, Bangkok, Montreal, Naples, Rio de Janeiro all being examples of members of that organization, COMET, large rail properties with 500 million trips per year, New York City and Hong Kong are examples, and then international bus benchmarking. And the benefit of those international programs is that the Imperial College of London manages the overall effort, has administrative capability, and does a number of analyses for these three groups. They, in best practice, they define benchmarking as a structured approach to identifying actions that lead to superior performance. It's not merely a comparison of data or creation of tables, but what they do is look at performance from agency to agency to stimulate productive questions and lines of inquiry. And that then leads to more in-depth analysis and research that the university helps with. So they do a lot of things like focusing on detailed case studies each year on best practices in operations and management. But fundamentally, it's a forum for agencies to share information and exchange ideas. And we don't really have anything like that in the United States. It would be great if maybe the FTA could fund something like that and the university would partner up. I think it's sorely needed in the United States. But with the lack of that, what we're left doing, if we would like to benchmark, is a fairly intensive effort, which sort of one-time exercises that we attempt to answer specific questions that the board or committee might have. So if you go to the next slide, we talk about some limitations. It's very challenging to do U.S. transit apples-to-apples comparisons, and there's many different agency characteristics, congestion, service levels. Data accessibility is a challenge, and as an example, on-time performance is not reported in the National Transit Database. So we would have a sort of one-time exercise to track down the data, make phone calls to different agencies, understand and ask for definitions. There has been a transit working group, the Transit Finance Group, known as TFLEX, who has done some attempts in the past at a U.S. benchmarking. And what they found was that collecting the data requires a lot of time and money commitments and has been very difficult. And I think they finally kind of threw up their hands and gave up because it really required much more intense resources. And as I mentioned, having a university to partner with that can help with some of the analysis. So that said, I think there are some limitations, but, you know, if the board would like us to do benchmarking, we certainly would be happy to, as we have the resources, do benchmarking for different parts of our performance, different parts of our operation. And next slide. So a good place to start with benchmarking is to benchmark against ourselves. It doesn't mean that we won't benchmark against others, but we certainly want to look at how we're doing right now and how we can get better. And then looking at our peers is the next step. So let's do a good job of benchmarking against ourselves, and then we can move to looking at our peers and establishing how we're doing against peers who are most like us. There are some resources available to help you compare your operation to others, and we will continue to do that so that we are trying to compare apples to apples as much as we can. In terms of next steps, we will continue to monitor performance and report monthly and vital signs. Happy to report that next month you'll be seeing our first annual performance report, which talks about the performance of the organization in the last calendar year and is a nice summary of what's happened and been reported in vital signs in different areas of performance. And I mentioned about the performance spotlights that we'll continue to bring to you. And that concludes my presentation.
Thank you. I wanted to make a comment about calendar year versus fiscal year in terms of performance. And I know that you went through a process with the general manager about determining calendar year. As we go through governance more in detail about process, our commitment has been that we will evaluate the general manager on specific performance, on planned performance, both against budget, but actually actual service delivery and key criteria. If we do that, it's important that the performance data allow for quarterly, but more importantly, annual performance reviews with the general manager against the budget, which is the fiscal year. And I think it's important to just kind of put a pin in that as a set of assumptions about our accountability for the performance review with the general manager about this data. And it's not necessarily calendar year, but it is fiscal year-based data about the execution of the budget. So I know it works for a calendar year for you all, but may work better for us on a fiscal year, is all. Any other comments on vital signs, performance review? Mayor?
Yeah, my only comment would be, well, first of all, thanks for the report, but that we need to be comparing apples in terms of the data with dates and months and years. And there's some of the pages, you know, if you get further in the back, where the period is looked at January through December, then you're looking at April through whatever. I don't know the rationale behind all that, but it would be nice to have them in the same time periods, time frames, rather.
Hearing no other items on this, we'll move on to a completely non-controversial issue, station naming.
I'm back.
Thank you, Andrea.
As promised in March, when we talked about the actions that we were taking to prepare for the Dulles extension, and one was the blue-yellow realignment to come in 2012. We had talked as a group about the station name policy, and I provided most of the board members, some are new, with the policy at that time, and promised that I would come back with a review of the policy so that we may have a discussion, because we have an opportunity as we go forward. Lance Wyman, who was the original designer of the map, is working through some design concepts that we will test with our customers on how to portray the changes that are coming. But we really have an opportunity over the next, there are probably about three different spots where we will be changing maps, and we have signage changing as well. So this really provides a good opportunity to review our policy. Plus, I mentioned last time that I was before you that the policy had not been reviewed in 11 years. So it is a good time to talk about it. Let's go to the next page. Briefly, the policy is about helping customers find their way in the system of Metro and also to navigate the region as a whole. The policy speaks to station names and directs that they should be geographical in nature or that they help navigate and specifically address centers of activity. The length of the names is very specific. It says that there are not to be more than 19 characters for stations, or for transfer stations such as Metro Center and Gallery Place, that limit would be 13. There is a process that's laid out in the policy. The names are to come up through the jurisdictions with formal conveyance to you as the board, and that the board votes on them, and that the jurisdictions are to commit to funding the change of the signage and everything that would be related to changing of the name. The roles and responsibilities are also in there. Most directly, they talk about internally. For instance, Dave Kubitschek's organization required for the hardware of the stations and the like. And I would note that those are out of date as we've had changes through the years. Next page. The principles of the policy go back to when the system was developed initially. Jackson Graham, the first general manager, emphasized the need for that, talked about four different areas that the name should convey: natural, or as I like to think of as sort of intuitive, areas that are natural or come to mind for the region as a whole, such as Bethesda or Pentagon. Location by coordinate, streets or squares that people know. Traditional or colorful, I guess the best one on that one would be Foggy Bottom for colorful, and that they be limited to two words, but preferably one, two words with one hyphen. On that point of brevity, It's important, and we talked about this when I mentioned the online survey work that we did about how customers get their information when they're making their way through the system, that it needs to be by sound, by visual, and there are a whole host of other ways that people make their way through the system. So the visual and the audio cues are very important, and certainly the shorter the name, the better. Egress and ingress it becomes a safety issue if, frankly, customers are having a difficult time quickly sizing up which direction they need to get out of because we have a very long, long name. It assists with those that have ADA requirements for signage, and particularly audio on that front. Through the work that I've done just in the short time that I've been here, it has come up, for instance, in the fair focus groups that we did, unprompted, customers ask about brevity and shortening the names, although we have not done a piece of work on it to date. And then this is the nation's capital, and I checked recently with Destination DC, and I think on an annual basis, we welcome 7 million visitors to Washington. And so that there are all sorts of languages here. So wayfinding is very important. And the launching point of this, of course, was our beloved map, which is iconic, and the implications that it may have there. Next page. So station signage today, here's some examples. Today, we have 15 of 86 stations that exceed 19 characters. And 7 of those have more than one hyphen. 3 of the 8 transfer stations exceed 13 characters. The pylons that you're looking at right here were designed pretty much for one line of type to be quickly sized up. And then you can see some other limitations if we go on to the next page. Next slide. I think the sign to your right gives an example of what I was talking about, being able to quickly decide where you're going. And I know it's been a struggle. We do have a manual with standards, but some of these have been stretched, and obviously we've had gone beyond whatever was in the manual. Next slide. for you, Mr. Downs, some vehicle signage. Inside, generally, the sign that you're looking at that says Red Line Reagan National, those are the transition signs that are above head, above the away. Most of those are 20 characters long. On the sides of the train are 14 characters long. And I'd like to play for you an announcement. If you could go back to the slide and hit the train announcement for me. I'll keep going back. There we go. So, nope.
Customers, this is U Street, African American Civil War Memorial, Cardozo. Doors will open on the left side. Green Line Train 2, Greenbelt.
So I think that over time what has happened is that the names are becoming a marketing tool. And understand that there's a deep connection to the neighborhoods and the communities and the landmarks that have come to be a part of the names. So I appreciate that, but I also think that we should review these and talk to our customers about them. And so if we could go to the next slide. How could I forget? If I could introduce to you Joseph Reynolds, who's the Acting Chief of Vehicle Programs, and Joseph and I and a team, I'm part of the team that's working on the 7K design, 7,000 series designs. Yeah. Ta-da. And I think that some of you that have been here before know that if you work with Dave Kubicek, you get to have a show and tell. And so this is a sign that's been developed for the new train cars. And
we should say it's a prototype at this stage.
Yes.
But we did commit that we were going to do something like this.
So, so it's been well received in the initial testing that we've done. The customers that have been in the focus group have liked it quite a lot. Joseph and the team, they're working on expanding it as far as we can lengthwise at the moment and also heightwise so that we can get the greatest amount of visibility possible. But you'll see as the sign operates that the longer the station names that we have, the more difficult it is going to be to read the sign. And I will say that one of the transit properties that's been using this format and this concept very well is in the New York subway system, and people appreciate it a great deal. And in the online research that we did, you'll recall that I told you that, and in your own personal experiences, we find ourselves looking out the window to figure out where we are. And so anyway, it was too fun not to have this here. And there you have it.
Mr. Giancola.
Yeah, I'm assuming this is the actual size of it, too, right?
We're working on making it a little...
Yeah, I mean, even from here, I can barely read it, so it's... And I know I'm old, and I have poor eyesight, but I have very corrective lenses here. So it's... Yeah, it's...
And we are refining the pixels and to make it as clear as possible, so...
This would be inside of rail vehicles or inside the station, posted
inside the new
car.
Rail cars.
At the header inside. Okay.
On the side.
Okay.
Yeah, between the two doors inside.
Okay.
No.
Okay.
We will also have one of the ones above there too in the train. You know, we have multiple. The new cars will have multiple points for information about station stops in them.
Exterior of the cars, we'll have two signs on the side. Typically right now we just have one, so we'll have two of those. You'll still have the sign at the header of the rail car, and then this signage right in here right now, we're looking at two of these on the interior. And so, again, the cars, you know, are only about 9 feet wide or so we'll get you a little bit closer. But this is, a prototype that we're looking at.
Mr. Nichols?
Yes. Could you provide me a little bit more context around cost allocation, and timing? You're saying that this is a program that it's part of our capital budget now, or give me additional context.
We are buying 7,000 series cars.
Right.
And we are going to, and there's a lot of amenities associated with that.
Right.
Part of that is conveying information on your destination.
Right.
And this is part of that package.
Okay, so this will be a part of the new cars that are coming in.
Yes.
And okay. Yeah. That's the part of the need.
Obviously, the key thing here is the more layers you put in, the smaller the type gets, and it goes back to the readability.
Got it.
Right, and these are in the new cars. These are not. We don't have an ability to put them in the older ones, but okay. All right, Dave? Yeah? Okay. So next slide. Yeah, please. No? Oh, I like it. recommendations for consideration. One is that we stay true to the policy in terms of the naming principles about location, centers of activity. I think that those provisions have served us well, that we also try to stay within the length of the name going forward on our names, that we continue to have names come up through the jurisdictions and through a formal conveyance. There are multiple organizations that I've heard from that are considering changing station names. And for our organization, and certainly to manage this, it's important that they come up through the jurisdictions and onto the board. So there are many, many, many names and options being discussed today. That the cost is a little outdated, that it's currently in the policy at $100,000, and we would like to include in the policy a process by which you go through. For instance, if we're doing a system-wide change, perhaps the incremental cost that we would not, WMATA would not be otherwise doing, should be paid for by the jurisdiction that changes it. But we want to go through the process of how that, how you would come up with the cost, rather than just putting it at $100,000. Customer input, I would recommend that we put a provision in there about customer feedback on names. I would also suggest that we have an opportunity now to validate the policy and that we test some of the names and maybe even some ways to depict station names in some research work. We are silent in the policy currently about naming rights. And so one recommendation that I heard from the board previously on this, it would seem that you would want, or I would recommend, the consideration of precluding commercial naming rights at this time, but that would be something you could consider to change going forward. And finally, of course, at another level, the roles and the people who are responsible in there in the policy should be changed. For instance, my organization should have responsibility for the research, the consumer research part of it, while Dave's organization should have the responsibility for the signage, the costing out of the signage, and anything that would be within the system for structural reasons. Our next steps would conduct some customer outreach in June to validate the policy, maybe get some ideas from customers about how to depict some of the names. In July, would have some revisions for consideration. In September, station name submissions. Some of the jurisdictions have talked to us about station names and when we would be going forward with the changes for June and for the 2012 changes. So we should have those before the board in September for your consideration. And in October, the board, we would think that the board would act on station name changes for the 2012 map.
Could I ask a couple of questions? Tell me the character capacity of the PIDs by station.
For the prediction, it is 8 characters. So you see the name of the station itself and how many more minutes, the destination station and how many more minutes, that is 8 characters. And I believe that there are 14 in the field for, if there are customer service alerts that we have to put in there, 14 to 16.
On the internal car, I'm not sure what the right term is, next stop.
That's 20. Is that?
That's 20 characters?
Uh-huh, yep.
So there is actually a technological limitation on the characters that can be put into the system?
That is correct.
We're not differentiating very well between what people want as public marketing, and I'll be the first to admit that we have probably the longest name in the system.
And I'm not,
and the shortest, but
which one?
Whether or not, I'm not going to debate the wisdom of that, obviously, but we have two potentially competing and unclear purposes here. One is information for the rider, which has to be succinct and fit within a technology limitation. And the other is the yellow pages that people want to see on pylons and maps and stuff that we need to probably recognize the legitimacy of the need for the Yellow Pages. And if you want to put Home Depot and you want to put the Nationals and you want to put a variety of other things, that's a different set of constraints that we need to tell people about for the customer focus that we have to have here. And there's specific limitations on that, that both I think the customer and the jurisdictions need to be accountable for making recommendations about both. It doesn't matter what it looks like from, say, U Street, African American, Civil War, Memorial, Cardoza. It's what, for me, is equally important, or actually more important, is what shows up on the PID and what shows up in the rail car itself. And that's, we've kind of brushed past that. I think we need to formalize it somehow and say the limitations on the cars for naming is 19 characters. And on the PIDs, it's eight. So you can be anything you want as long as you know that on the system, in the announcements, on the cars, there's a limitation in the characters, and you can pick with some customer review, you can pick both, because I think it is not as confusing to see all of that stuff on a pylon or on a map as it is to try and sort through it on a on the PID or on the rail car.
I would also add passenger announcements, similar to what we heard here. I mean, I actually live at the U Street station, so by the U Street station. So I think it's much easier for a customer just to get U Street on the train, and I think I would add that to the mix. Also on that display, there's probably some limitations there, and actually if you get it down to one line, you probably can look at probably larger words. Or larger size words on that. So that's also something you might want to consider. But I think our obligation at the end of the day is to our customers. I actually appreciate the fact that you're going to take this through focus group testing and actually discussions with our customers to determine what works best for them. So I think that provides some counterbalance to what we're hearing from jurisdictions. And I appreciate the fact that we want to incorporate as much of the neighborhood icons onto that map and onto our signage, but I also think there has to be a balance, and I think we, at the end of the day, owe it to our customers to come up with clear names.
Ms. Hudgens?
I want to thank you for the information item, because I think this gives us a broader guideline from the old policy, and while I began, I want to take the opportunity to recognize Mayor Dave Benanetis, who's here from the town of Herndon. And the considerations that are coming from the jurisdictions. But I go to Mr. Acosta's point that, first of all, we are already and will be getting information from the public. And I think sort of what we have before us are some base guidelines of it, so that we can have this discussion in a manner that it hopefully removes us from those larger pieces that we kind of lost the sight. That we really want to give a clarity of the user of the system and the convenience of that use. And we pointed out the ADA piece. There are pieces there that bear that. So what we're looking today is simply taking this as the recommendations that are provided and coming back to update our timetable on this committee as to an approval process and walking us through. And I think the information has been very helpful in being able to do that.
I think it's important as well, though, to tell people that there are technology limits that
That's exactly what we can't.
It's not just that the old policy was 19 characters. There's a reason for it, mm-hmm. and we're not being rigid. It is simply trying to fit it within the capacity box that we have.
May I ask another question from Mr. Kubitschek or the general manager? Because we've spoken about the PIDs And I think in the capital program we have the upgrade, and I guess I just need to have an update as to, we talked about the technology piece that's coming forward. What's the timing when we will see a change of opportunities to have better technology?
On the PIDS system itself?
Well, I'm not sure if it's the PIDS only or other pieces.
There was an upgrade to the server that has driven, that's driving the current system because of its age and everything else. We don't really have anything, one specific project that I've seen that's identified to address all of the respective systems. It's something that we've started, you know, looking at because of the age of the hardware that we have. And we're really trying to look at a package deal. And so, you know, with that, for example, we would like to be able to tie it into our into a larger type server system that is more responsive, because right now it works off of a kind of a predictive type pattern, and it's not always, you know, down to the right minute. And we're looking at maybe a possibility of pulling off some information off the train control that would provide, you know, an accurate pinpoint process instead of this, you know, predictable process that it has to hit certain marks. So it's going to take a little bit of time to get that, you know, populated out there. But that's the review process that we're working on right now.
That's more to the technology. I mean, ultimately what you'd like to have is change out the whole thing and go with what you see on other systems, which are much better. But I will tell you that, and I will double check, such a system change out is not in the current capital program that I can recall.
Mr. Downey. I would agree with others. Our major obligation has to be the customer convenience and safety in terms of where they're going and how they're moving through the system. I would also argue that short, memorable, clearly identifiable names work for the collateral users as well. If people want to advertise Macy's is at 34th Street, you don't have to change the name. People will remember 34th Street. People would remember Grosvenor. People would remember Gallery Place. If it's memorable, everybody can associate with it. My icon, my service, my company, whatever it is at that station, and the station name is really what sticks in people's minds.
Thank you. Just a couple of things. One is, I think this is a good policy moving forward, but I just wanted to clarify that we're not planning to go backwards and change anything that's already been done. Is that correct?
Not at this time, but I would recommend that we ask customers, and I do plan to ask them their opinion about some names. I think it's important to do that. I don't think it's been done in a long time. So, I mean, certainly when you're asking them about the policy, I have to provide examples to get reaction. Mm-hmm. And I don't have in mind yet, but I might like to also test some concepts for showing some of this. For instance, the shorter the name, the better, and perhaps some of the other names can be placed on our neighborhood maps that we have worked on that are in the stations. That, you know, we're now in a digital age. So I'm not sure, for instance, a lot of the information, I go back to the map, that's on the map might need to all be there. Maybe we can put it online, or you can look for it in other places. I had an opportunity to be on the judging panel for Greater Washington, had a map designing contest. And one of the concepts that came up was that you would have a dominant station name, and then the secondary piece of it might come below it. And I thought, wow. So it may seem very simple, but we should look at things like that. I think we should.
Yeah, and I would very much agree with that concept. The other thing that I was going to say is that in addition to having different lengths of name shown in different forms, might it also be possible to include something in the station or at the entrance to the station that would have names of landmarks in the area that wouldn't have to be on the station name at all, but if you knew you were headed to Macy's, for example, and you got off at 34th Street, it would say Macy's is one block this way or whatever.
Right, and then also I would say we don't have to do this all at the same time. We're going to have several versions as we march forward as we get to the Dulles extension. So there could be we could do phases of you know trying to tighten it up. It doesn't have to all happen all at once. So,
Ms. Hines.
Thank you, Mr. Downs. I'm focused a little bit here, Barbara, on the interplay between the role of the jurisdiction and the role of WMATA. And not having been around for any kind of naming, it's as I read this and I read your report, it sounded to me like the WMATA board voting was pretty much a rubber stamp of what the jurisdiction sent forward. I don't know if that's a fair characterization, but the question I have is on this issue of the involvement of riders and getting customer feedback, it would help me very much to sort of see a chronology. If part of what Metro is going to say is our part is some customer research and some testing of a variety of different names, seems to me that has to happen before the jurisdiction votes. And we have to own that as part of our process. Because having that happen after the jurisdiction already voted begins to then say, well, okay, so maybe really the final say is with the Metro Board in a more powerful way than I perceive what the relationship was before. So I just lay that on the table. I don't understand that interplay myself, but when I read this, I'm confused, and I'm confused about what riders would be being told.
I think that would be a good idea to maybe indicate that that research could be done in advance of coming or in collaboration with, or I'd appreciate some thoughts on that. I understand what the trouble spot would be.
I would say, though, that 30 years ago, there was much more of a consensus regionally and with the board about the limitations of station naming, and it was that there were 19 characters, and the simpler the better, single name, and that was generally shared. I think I'd probably also have to acknowledge that the district is probably the one that, when we went through the process of naming the green-yellow line, kind of broke that consensus by...
And everybody else seems to have gone along.
And everybody else then followed the lead of that. And so I think there has been a change in assumptions around the respective roles. And it just is what it is now.
Well,
and trying to find
a... want it to be.
Right. Right. But it still fits within... I hate to say it still fits within a technology box that we have to acknowledge, and that it has a purpose with the customers first. And then, Mr. McKay.
The good news about waiting a long time to be recognized is most people are thinking the same thing I was. But I am, I guess, one concern that I have is there's clarity in the length of the name, and then there's clarity to riders as to actually what's there. And it was acknowledged earlier on that we do have a lot of tourists coming into the area, and at some point in time we're going to have to divide station name from giving customers good information about what is at a station. And Gallery Place is a good example. If you didn't, you know, if Verizon Center wasn't mentioned and you're a one-time rider coming to the Verizon Center, you wouldn't know it's at Gallery Place if it wasn't listed there. And so I do think we have to be careful in what we use as a technological restraint and how we provide good information to customers as to what they might actually find at some of these stations. And that's going to be a challenge that I think we have to deal with. But my main concern is the one that Ms. Hines was touching on, which is, you know, when I look at the recommendations for consideration and I see that jurisdictions move forward with this and then I see customer input put current policy NA, that may be the current policy, but that may not be the current practice. Our jurisdictions are our customers, too. And I can speak from my own jurisdiction to say we hear from a lot of customers about name ideas, and particularly with the Dulles, I've heard from more people than I can tell you what their opinion is about, you know, what the names should be for some of these stations. And so we need to have a better way of blending the two processes so that we're not at a point where we have a disagreement. And if we're very clear, I guess one of the questions is on the guidelines that are given that have been in place, the current policy, the 19 characters and the 13 characters for transfer stations. I mean, that information obviously at some point in time was not being followed by the jurisdictions, and then when it came to the Metro Board was in the awkward position of deciding whether they want to support the jurisdiction or support the larger needs of the organization. Seems to me the solution to that would be much earlier on in the process to have Metro in a conversation with the jurisdiction so that we don't end in a place where what's coming to us is contrary to what is in our policy. And I think the major fix to this problem is the communication between the jurisdictions and the staff way before it comes to the WMATA board for action.
If I could.
I think Mr. Giancola was next.
Yeah, let me just react to something that Ms. Porter said with regard to landmarks and such. There are signs, for instance, at the station I get off of most of the time, Tacoma, the shortest name in the system, am I there? Can we get some extra letters?
No. Tied with King Street.
No, that's street. You have a street.
ST. It says ST.
but there's a dot. Okay. But at any rate, there are signs you have now inside the stations and usually on the platforms that show a map of the area. And I think those signs need to be updated. But also those signs need to be outside the station, at least in the Metro property, because people get off or get on, they want to see at that point where everything is, not when they're on the platform. So maybe just the location of some of those signs would be helpful. Now, with regard to naming stations, I could care less what the Silver Line stations are called. So from my community input, I don't think you should be asking people in my area what they think the Silver Line station should be at. Certainly it should be those stakeholders around those stations and maybe focus groups. You know, I that's my personal opinion, but you can disagree with it, but that's my opinion. So I'm more of those along those lines in station naming.
I just want to bring a conclusion and an understanding, because on the next steps we have July following the June customer information and a September name submissions and the approval in July and a submission of names. And what I'm understanding from this is that we will have adopted a new policy, and we will have provided an opportunity of a submission of names, and I would say a resubmission if the policy has some revision of that. And I'm only just thinking of where we are, because we originally had a different time frame when we started this process, so that there's some clarity as to how do we accept input that's given. For example, input has come to the Metro Board by communications from the jurisdictions regarding the Silver Line, but it's based on the policy of before, and we're moving forward. So is that where we are?
The only thing we have not made clear is what we put on the trains and on the PIDs. And that has to ultimately be us. They can call it anything you'd like, but we still have to fit it within the capacity. And there needs to be, I think, more conversation about that with the jurisdictions. Because it can't have an assumption that the entire name goes into both the PID and into the car identifier itself. And that's part of our obligation to the customer. I think we have intentionally or unintentionally made room for much larger names, figuring out ways of accommodating that within the system on maps and on pylons, et cetera, is one thing, but living within the constraints of the technology is another. We can't have people assume, for instance,
it's impossible to get the U Street African American Civil War Memorial Cardoza into any kind of configuration on a car or any place else. And we need to be responsible for trying to pick what makes sense about how that's displayed for the customer.
In addition to how we display it, I think we have to get a sense of how customers will read it. Even if they can read it, if we have a series of names that are so difficult to distinguish one from another that people will not be able to wayfind themselves through the system, is an issue for us.
Mr. Chairman, one other question, because you mentioned there are a number of station name submissions that are being worked on. I mean, I'm aware of some of them. I may not be aware of all of them. Are they generally consistent with the current policy?
Not all of them.
Okay.
There are 20. There are 20 that I have heard of that have been discussed okay. in various forms.
I think we need to know what those are, and we
I
need
can
to know, and we yep. need to know soon, because what I don't want to do is, if some of these are already well down the path and well established, I don't want it to appear that we're going and changing our policy at the tail end of a long process that others have already gone down to establish something. If they haven't gone down a long path of doing that, that may be different, mm-hmm. but I think we need to see which ones are in the queue right now and how they may or may not be affected by any of the policy changes that we're considering.
Yeah, and some of them, you know, honestly, maybe have not come all the way up to jurisdiction consideration, but people have been talking about them, and I think you're right. It's important for you to know that. If I could, I wanted to make a comment about research. And while one community, there may be community input, for instance, I agree, Mr. Giancola, I think that's really important. But it's also important for us to remember that the system is used by the entire region. And also by millions of visitors who come. So that's probably where the difference is between the jurisdictions and WMATA's research. And so how we incorporate that at the beginning, I would agree, in the interest of time and money, you know, to work together to do that is important. And also the third thing I'd say is that, again, we don't have to do these all at once. Starting in June 12th, 2012. In fact, I would say it's probably would be almost really very, very difficult to do it. But at least if we get some research results in, we understand, we might take some direction, make some recommendation. Over time, as we're going through the phases, we can update and make changes.
We look forward to the July review of the customer research. Is that July?
Well, certainly the policy piece of it, we're going to move as quickly as possible to get all the research results in. But okay. We needed to start here.
Now that we've named this thing to death,
yeah,
the committee is adjourned.